This is Virginia Insight.
I'm Tom Graham.
You're concerned about the environment, perhaps especially climate change. You know fossil fuels are problematic, so you try to drive less, maybe ride your bike or take the train when you can. But what about the color of your house? What would happen if you painted your roof white? How about that tree in the front yard? Is it helping? Should you plant more of the same kind? Or might there be a more climate-friendly species? While we've all heard about greenhouse gases from burning fuel, science is pursuing a huge number of other factors now thought to also affect climate. Using immensely powerful computers and modeling incredibly complex scenarios, researchers are uncovering problems and seeking out solutions in ways most of us had never imagined. But imagine we will, when Deborah Lawrence and Hank Shugart, two Virginia scientists at the forefront of this type of research, are our guests, right after the news.
Great to be with you. I'm Tom Graham, and this is Virginia Insight. Here to help, two University of Virginia scientists who are leading different research projects into different aspects of the future of Earth's climate. In addition to the projects we'll be asking them to describe, Deborah Lawrence is a former science advisor to the Office of Environment at the U.S. State Department and current scientific advisor in the International Programs Office of the U.S. Forest Service. Hank Shugart is the author of close to a dozen books on environmental science, including, from several years ago, How the Earthquake Bird Got Its Name, as well as the just-released Foundations of the Earth. Dr. Lawrence, Dr. Shugart, thank you both for making time for us on Virginia Insight.
Glad to be here.
With those books, buy 5 copies for your mother.
Well, Deborah Lawrence, with that, I'm going to turn to you first. And then maybe we can let Hank on this as well. How do trees affect climate? And do different types of trees actually affect climate differently?
That's a good question. If you think about climate is really made up of two things. You know, how warm is it? What's the temperature? And what kind of precipitation do you have? So when you think about trees and the forests in which they occur, trees affect the temperature in a couple of ways. They can actually control greenhouse gases. Carbon dioxide is one of our major greenhouse gases, and it is the fuel for trees. Trees take up carbon dioxide in photosynthesis.
So they take carbon dioxide
out of the atmosphere.
This sort of bad greenhouse gas, at least that's how we're thinking of it currently. Away.
They take it away. And it's a really important part of the carbon cycle. Without trees, we would have a lot more CO2 in the atmosphere today.
And things would be a lot warmer.
So they take in carbon dioxide. The other thing they do is that they can either reflect or absorb the sunlight. So if they reflect it, that's going to be a warming. If they reflect it, it's cooling. If it's absorption, it's a warming.
Explain that to me.
Well, depending on what kind of leaves you have, what kind of branch structure, whether you're a conical tree or a big mushroom-type tree, the surface interacts with incoming radiation in different ways. So sometimes it's more reflective, sometimes it's less.
And that's largely based on the species, the type of tree?
It is.
Okay.
And so that's one of those places where different species do have different effects. They also have different effects depending where they are on the planet. So trees in the far north might interact with the sun differently than trees at the tropics. The other important things that trees do is move water. They move water from the soil into the atmosphere. So you can't get rain until you have moisture in the atmosphere. And one important way that you get moisture in the atmosphere is because plants move it from their roots, through their tissues, out their leaves, into the atmosphere. So that's a cooling, that's generally a cooling effect that trees have on the climate.
But also a precipitation effect.
Yeah.
You have enough trees of a certain type who tend to bring a lot of water up from the earth and it evaporates through their leaves?
It does. And in fact, this is responsible for a lot of recycling of water. So the water will come in off the oceans. We've got lots of oceans, lots of water vapor. But in many continental areas, there's an important amount of recycling that occurs because forests are pumping a lot of water through their system.
Well, I'm looking at you because I think you know a little bit about trees, Hank.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah. Well, it's interesting. I was listening to what Deb was saying. And, of course, sometimes you think there's really no new questions or ideas under the sun. As a UVA professor, I'm required by law to mention Thomas Jefferson in anything I do formal before the public. And, you know, Jefferson in his day opined that cutting the forest of Virginia would, over time, restore a benign climate to Virginia that would mimic the climate at in Europe, which he thought was a nicer place at high latitudes than here because of the fact of being cleared. An opinion that Noah Webster was adamantly against in New England. He noticed that after the clearing of the New England woods, that frost followed the plow, that the snow stayed in the fields longer than in the forest, and that clearing land promoted cooling, not a warming and a pleasant climate. And it turns out Gordon Bonin, one of the people that Deb and I are both working with on these projects, it sort of links them together in a way, was able to show using one of these modern computer models. In fact, Mr. Webster was probably correct in his assertions. The idea that the forest of the earth or the forest of a location can alter the climate is an old idea. Columbus wrote to his sons that he thought the Canary Islands were so dry was due to the fact they'd been denuded of vegetation by goats, basically, and that the Caribbean was full of wet, rainy islands where trees promoted the rain, which was also has been demonstrated to be, in fact, meteorologically correct. So when we mess around with the surface of the earth, we are dealing with one piece of a very interactive system, and sometimes we don't always know which way those interactions are going to go. And both of us are basically involved in trying to understand better what changes to the planet's surface are liable to do to the climate.
And I want to ask you about these two projects that involve some incredibly complex computer modeling that each of you are doing in your areas of specialty with colleagues from around the world. But for anybody who just joined us, I should mention that systems ecologist Deborah Lawrence and Hank Shugart are our guests. Both are professors of environmental science at the University of Virginia. This is Virginia Insight. I'm Tom Graham. We've already got some calls coming in, but we do have lines open still at 888-WMRA. Talk next to Mount Sydney. Ken, thanks for joining us. Your question or comment for our guests, please.
Hi. I was wondering about Milankovitch cycles and their inclusion in the global climate models. If they are included, is there any way to tell when the next downturn in temperature might be? And if they're not included, isn't that a significant oversight?
Yeah, basically the Milankovitch cycles are operating over pretty long timescales with respect to a century or even a millennia. We're talking about cyclical changes in the incoming solar radiation due to variations in the Earth's orbit around the sun. And these things have periodicities of 27,000 years, 40,000 years, 105,000 years. If we're, you know, we're far from being able to predict what people are going to be doing 20 millennia from now. Incidentally, the way the cycles stand right now, we should be on the cusp of a fairly extended cooling period, which makes the instrumental record that indicates a warming seem to be something that's not really being caused by those cycles. So that the Milankovitch cycles do not loom large in predicting climate over the course of a century or two, which is what these models that are being used for assessing climate change do. But they would, if they were somehow folded into the discussion, they don't contravene the notion that we're doing something to the planet's climate that's causing it to warm.
Ken, thank you so very much for that terrific question. I didn't even know there was something called the Milankovitch scale.
Actually, his birthday was yesterday.
So this is named after a guy.
Milan Milankovitch, who was one of the famous Serbian mathematicians, one of the few Serbian mathematicians I've ever heard of, ever.
But do you know how old he was yesterday?
Well, he's dead, so he's
100 and something.
We have this on Facebook from Lauren, who says, in terms of amount of increase in average temperature, predictions about how much climate is going to warm up over the next 50 years seem to vary greatly. Could lack of agreement be a contributing factor to those who belittle the idea of climate change? Or am I incorrect? Is there a basically agreed upon prediction about the amount of warming that is coming?
I think that's a good question, Lauren. The fact is that there is quite a bit of agreement about how much warming is coming. It's about 3.5 to 8 degrees Fahrenheit, probably not in the next 50 years, but more like in the next 100. Whether or not the lack of agreement is real is another question. In fact, what you see when you see the spread of models is not just a bunch of scientists who can't agree. It's the fact that they cannot figure out what humanity is going to do. So those different scenarios that you may have seen, they spread out, not based on the fact that we don't understand the climate system well. We have some more to do, for sure, but we don't know what humanity is going to do, and the different pathways that we take will have different consequences for the climate. So a lot of what you see in terms of the different possible futures has to do with what humans choose to do in the coming decades. Really, the next 10 or 20 years will tell us what's going to happen in the next 100.
Yeah, I think I agree with most everything Deb has said. The one thing I would throw out is some of the models, the models do have some significant differences one from another that do cause different responses. You know, for example, if you're making a model of how the climate works for the Earth, one of the things you got to do is freeze the ocean correctly. If you have frozen ocean water, you've got a white reflective surface. If it has snow on it, it really cools the Earth like crazy. If you've got not ice-covered ocean, it absorbs all the incoming sunlight very effectively.
So you're talking about what happens at the poles or near the poles.
Okay. So if you think the part of the ocean that's mixing and capturing heat is 70 meters deep, which some models do, you freeze the ocean a lot easier, more easily, than if you think it's 90 meters deep, which others of the models use as their number. It turns out the mixing depth of the ocean is not something that you just sort of dream up. It's very hard to get measurements. It's not the easiest place to sample. There's all sorts of reasons we need to know more about ocean circulation to really understand this thing. So Deb's spot on. There's a lot of uncertainty that comes from the fact that that the projections of carbon dioxide and other greenhouse gases being released presupposes you understand the human economy, among other things, over 50-year time periods. There are also some fairly significant scientific questions that need to be investigated. But one of the nice things about models is you can play with them and see how much your errors push them around. And in a sense, that envelope of variation is partially due to the human uncertainty from not knowing what we're going to do as a people. Some of it is due to the fact that we have different underlying theories about how the Earth works, all of which could stand being tested.
Hank Sugar, you used a phrase that I just want to make sure I was tracking, how the human economy changes in the future.
Sure, because if you're going to predict the amount of carbon dioxide and methane and other chemicals in the atmosphere, those things are often tied to things like the energy generation sector of a nation, the industrial sector of a nation. So to really predict the climate 100 years from now, somewhere in that calculation, you have to have a prediction of how much the economy is going to develop and industry will be releasing things in the atmosphere. That's a hard thing to know.
Systems ecologists Hank Sugart and Deborah Lawrence have both recently, how would you say, taken on new projects that relate directly to modeling about climate change. And we're going to ask them more specifics about that because I'm sure they can explain it better when we get back. It was in 1984 that Hank Sugart says he first got hooked on studying the northernmost forests of the world and how those forests can both react to and contribute to changes in climate. Today, much of Dr. Sugart's work is focused on the Great Boreal Forest of northern Russia. Deborah Lawrence got started studying cultivation practices in Indonesia in the late 1980s, researching how those practices affect both the environment and the people who use them. Today, Dr. Lawrence and Dr. Shugart are using what they've learned to study highly complex scenarios about climate change. My name, by the way, is Tom Graham. This is Virginia Insight, and I'm not sure about Hank, Deborah, but I've heard a rumor that you absolutely love the idea of computer modeling. And that's directly related to this new project that you're heading up.
That's correct. I don't know a lot about computer modeling. I love what I know, in that computer models allow you to do experiments with the entire Earth that you could never do in reality. You just could never log the entire boreal forest or all of Amazonia or all of Borneo.
When you say log, you mean cut it down.
Cut it down. You can't do it just to find out what it does to the climate. But in a model, you can. And you can use that information to understand how the land surface affects the climate. So that is the goal of our project, is to understand how the decisions we make, millions of people, millions of farmers, how those decisions add up to a global climate system. And if we push those decisions in a certain direction, can we have a better climate future or not?
And I want to ask you more about that, because there's some fascinating stuff that you've been doing, I understand, Deborah Lawrence, that we haven't even touched on yet. But we have touched a little bit, Hank Shugart, on this whole idea of trees.
Yes.
And you've been working on this for a long time.
Yeah, I remember some of those trees when they were young.
But tell us a little bit more about this idea that one of the things that you're looking at in your models of the boreal forest is both how the forest will react to climate change and then how the forest itself might cause further climate change based on how it reacts?
Yes. All this stuff got started years ago when I got involved in building models that predicted forests based on growing every single tree on a forest location someplace, along with who shaded whom and all the interactions.
Tell us a little bit about that, because from what I've heard, you go tree by tree in a computer model that is eventually going to be considering billions of trees?
Trillions, probably.
Tell us how that works.
Well, this is why God invented the computer, I guess. These would be things that would be almost impossible to do. They would be impossible to do by hand. And I got interested in working with them because I was at Oak Ridge National Laboratory, connected to one of the biggest computers in the world. So I was interested in big problems. Initially, we started simulating forest tree at a time for areas, and we found we could reproduce the forest in places back in the last ice age and stuff. We could do past climate, and that inspired us to take on future climate. Right now, we're doing Russia. Basically, Russia is very, very big. The forest of Russia is roughly, the biggest forest in the world, is roughly the size of the lower 48 states, and it's a monster. We essentially are looking at it on about a 12-mile grid, and we're simulating on the order of, probably 30 trillion trees a year and how each one of them adds a tree ring or dies or is born to do the Russian forest. So there's a tremendous amount of detail in terms of how tall the trees are and what's going on. There's also a lot of biology, because these models essentially grow trees by taking what any good forester would tell you is the growth rate and how tall the trees get and what conditions it takes for them to regenerate. So there's a lot of very common sense field ecology boiled into the models, and then the computers do this massive bookkeeping job for you. We're interested in testing the models any way we can. We've done a lot of things with them. I mean, if you're doing a climate model, you ought to be able to run the model for the conditions that go up a mountainside and get the place where the hardwood forest turns to conifer forest at the right altitude. If you can't do that, you're probably not in the right ballpark. So one of the things we've beaten ourselves to death with is figuring out how to test models that predict things hundreds and even thousands of years out in time. And I would like to say we've been fairly successful at that. We've tried to dream up all sorts of novel and strange tests. But right now our main issue is to take them up to much, much larger scales. The computers have gotten stronger, and we've sort of grown up with them. And my real interest is to be able to take all the forests right now in the boreal zone, the great northern dark conifer forest of Canada, Scandinavia, Russia, and look at how they change over time. We've done some model experiments that have been back-checked against remote sensing data. And it turns out climate change in the Russian forest promotes a change in the surface that changes the way Siberia reflects light into space, particularly in the winter, and furthers a warming of the planet. So you warm Siberia 3 degrees, and you get about a degree and a half kick onto that warming.
Help me track what you're saying, Hank Sugart. Is there something about the type of forest that's growing now in that huge area of northern Russia that is contributed to warming or to cooling?
It's contributing to warming. If you warm it, it contributes to warming. If you cool it, it makes it cooler. The forest, about half of the Russian forest.
And that's because the type of...
The types of trees.
Species that predominate
right.
change.
Yeah, there's
based on temperature.
Based on temperature. The half of the Russian forest is what's called larch forest. Covers an area about like eastern North America, or eastern United States, rather. And it loses its leaves in the wintertime. So when it drops its leaves, what it's exposed is snow. So the surface reflects all the incoming light.
And that makes the climate cooler.
If you warm that forest, you regenerate spruce and fir, good old Christmas trees, dark conifers that absorb light like crazy and heat. And you end up warming the place. So you warm it, you change the place to spruce trees, that promotes more warming. So it rolls itself up as a positive feedback.
And so what's been happening over the past few decades is that forest has been warming?
It has been warming. Siberia is warm more than anywhere else just about on the planet. It's over the last 6 decades, it's gotten a degree centigrade warmer every year in central Siberia.
And that's about 10 degrees Fahrenheit?
Yeah. Or so.
So as a result of that, you're getting more of the kinds of trees that create even further warming, and you're getting them on such a massive scale, billions of trees, that it's significant in its impact not only in Russia but the whole planet?
Yes. It's a substantial contribution to the Earth's total heat budget. So you're getting plain talk is, it warms the place up. And there's some evidence both in the mountains of Russia along the its southern border and also in Siberia that, in fact, these larch trees, the deciduous needleaf trees, are being replaced by dark conifers, spruce, and fir. So the thing that our model has been predicting seems to be occurring on the ground. We're not sure how extensively yet. We're trying to find that out with some satellite investigation work, but that's ongoing right now.
Dr. Deborah Lawrence, it's my understanding that a focus of much of your research is as far back as your doctoral dissertation more than 20 years ago had to do with something that I understand.
You look so young. How could that be?
Is called shifting cultivation.
That's
I
right.
wanted to say that, but I didn't think I'd get away with
yeah,
it.
Yeah, well, I'm...
Yeah. So tell us what shifting cultivation is.
Shifting cultivation is the way that we all used to do agriculture before we had fertilizers. And because it basically is agriculture using only the natural capital. So anything that the plants can store in them, anything that's in the soil, cut down some plants and burn it, and all those nutrients go into the soil, then you can grow a crop. That's it. That's what we all started out with. That was original agriculture. And in much of the tropics, through the early 2000s, this was still not dominant, but it was a widespread practice. And it was, the reason I was interested was it was right at the edge of the rainforest. It was one of the causes, major causes of deforestation was people going out to grow food. That is
no longer
the case.
And you started this research in Indonesia, the rainforest.
I did. I subsequently moved on and studied shifting cultivation in Mexico. It happens all over the world. Wherever there's tropical forest, there are people doing this practice because these are the people who, they don't have fertilizers. They don't have a lot of money. They are using nature's capital. And the questions I've been asking for my whole career is, Is it working? Is it working for them? Is it going to work in the future? And are those systems that they're farming in, these rainforest systems, are they going to come back? What can they do when they come back? Do they function the same way?
What do you mean by come back?
Well, if you cut down a rainforest and you leave it alone, it will come back. It'll come right back. The forest is resilient. But if you cut it again and again and again every 10 or 20 years, you sort of stop that recovery process in its tracks. And the question is, if you do that enough, do you somehow set it on a new trajectory where it's never going to come back to what it was? And I think the answer is that it really is not coming back to what it was. It will come back to a forest that is functional, that animals can use, that serves us well, that traps water, that provides all resources for humanity, but it's not the great, beautiful rainforest that it was.
I'm curious if you consider yourself, Dr. Deborah Lawrence, not only an ecologist, but a kind of anthropologist?
I was trained as a biological anthropologist in college, but I don't consider myself an anthropologist. I consider myself a person who figures that ultimately, as humans, we are still subject to what we can get from the earth. So in a sense, we are dependent on the natural systems of this planet. Forests, agriculture is just a modified natural system. We are dependent on the earth. So I'm interested in what we do to the earth, and I'm interested in how the earth provides for us. So in that sense, I'm interested in humanity. But I wouldn't say I'm an anthropologist. I'm sure they would be shocked to hear. I am working
yeah,
with
I've heard rumors, though, that you're particularly intrigued by how the kinds of things that you're studying in ecology, like shifting cultivation, affect people.
Absolutely. So I got into it because these people on the edge of the forest are trying to make a living. They're getting blamed for what looks like a horrendous act, which is clearing majestic forests. And yet they are some of the poorest people on the planet. So if they're going to do it, I'm going to hope that they're doing it in a way that's sustaining them and hopefully sustaining the system around them. And I've always worked with people who are more professionally trained than I am at addressing those questions of their well-being with anthropologists, real anthropologists, with economists, with rural sociologists, with people who can actually ask the questions that I can only look at and say, wow. I hope they're doing okay.
Systems ecologists Deborah Lawrence and Hank Shugart are our guests. Both are professors of environmental science at the University of Virginia. This is Virginia Insight. I'm Tom Graham. Our call-in number, easy to remember, as 888-WMRA-TALK. So, Deborah, Hank has explained some of what this project that he's heading up that involves scientists from around the world looking at northern forests of the world and using incredibly complex computer models to see how those changes in those forests could affect climate change and how climate change could cause changes. Tell us about the project that you're heading up.
My project is called Food, Fuels, and Forests. And that's supposed to pull together the notion that we have several needs for what we need to get out of the planet. We need to grow food to provide food for all of us, in fact, for an extra 2 billion people by the middle of the century. We need to have forests because they provide us with biodiversity, with watershed resources. They also provide us with some important climate controls, like taking up carbon dioxide. The other thing we might do with the surface of the earth, if we're thinking about a world where climate is changing, is we might grow biofuels. So that's the fuels part. And I'm really interested in my project in understanding how global scale land allocation decisions among forests, food, and biofuels end up altering the planet's climate. So we also have cities. You might notice that I didn't mention cities. Cities are a tiny fraction of the Earth's surface. They're a very important fraction because that's where we all live and do all the things that we do that change the climate, like use energy. But in terms of the impact of the surface itself on climate, you're really talking about the rest of the Earth's surface, the rest of the land surface in my case. And what are we going to do with that land surface? If we're trying to make the land surface work for us as a way to do climate policy, One of the very popular ideas that's come up in the last decade is to reduce emissions from deforestation and forest degradation. Keep those forests there. They take up every 10 tons of carbon dioxide we put in the atmosphere. Those forests and others, the boreal as well, take up about a fourth of them, 2.5. So that's carbon dioxide that would have gone into the atmosphere that is instead going into forests. So that's a climate service. Let's keep those forests. And in fact, in terms of our greenhouse gas emissions, anthropogenic emissions are 90% fossil fuels at this point, but still 10% tropical deforestation. So 10 to 12. So if we can avoid those emissions, we're going to make an impact on the climate.
So if there was no deforestation going on,
we'd be better off.
10% less.
We would.
Okay.
The other thing is, it's a twofer. You not only don't put the CO2 into the atmosphere, but you absorb more CO2. So we're losing out.
Because the trees are taking carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere.
So that's a really important option. Now, you put that out there as let's conserve all these forests. But the other thing we have out there is let's feed all these people. You know, food security is a big issue in many parts of the world. The places where the tropical forests are have a lot of food security issues. So there's this, it's not a clash, but it is a potential trade-off between growing food and maintaining forests.
Well, if you're growing crops, is that having some positive impact on the atmosphere in terms of temperature? I mean, obviously corn may not do the same thing for the climate as trees do, but does vegetation of that type do something?
It does, and it's really complicated, and that's why you need to use models. It turns out that when you deforest a large area and replace it with something that looks like corn or some kind of crop, you usually end up getting a warming. It's actually a warming effect to do that change. So it does affect the climate. It's not necessarily a good effect. It depends where you are on the planet. That's, again, why Hank and I are going to work together, because you deforest the tropics, you end up warming. You deforest the boreal zone, you end up cooling the planet. So that says a lot about where our future land use decisions are going to matter. It really matters where we choose to get our wood, where we choose to grow our future crops. It's gonna actually have a feedback on the climate.
Hank Shugart, I understand the story that you tell in at least one of your books has to do something that went on during the Cold War with Russia having an idea of how it could warm its northernmost regions up. And it had to do with coal and the oceans. And I want to ask you to explain that. And maybe we can also get you to explain the title of one of your books about the earthquake bird. So much more to get to, but we've got to pause for a break. We'll be back in a bit more than 1 minute. Okay, I'm curious. Have you had thoughts, ideas, ponderings about climate change that struck you as not exactly part of conventional wisdom? Have you heard such things from other people? Care to run those questions past a couple of highly regarded experts? Herman Hank Shugart's newest book is titled Foundations of the Earth, Global Ecological Change and the Book of Job. Just out, it is his 11th published book so far. Deborah Lawrence is a scientific advisor in the International Programs Office of the U.S. Forest Service and a former science advisor to the Office of Environment at the U.S. State Department. From their base at the University of Virginia, both Dr. Lawrence and Dr. Shugart are heading up different international projects studying different aspects of climate change. This is Virginia Insight. I'm Tom Graham. You want to take us back, Hank, to the Cold War?
Yeah,
and coal and the ocean, Russia?
It's interesting, actually, that in the time of the Cold War, one of the things that was actually proposed by a very well-known Russian climatologist, Leslie Badyuko, was to sprinkle coal dust across the Arctic ice and the Arctic Ocean, melt the Arctic Sea, and by his calculation, if you ever could melt all that ice once, you'd have water exposed, it would absorb the incoming sunlight and keep it warm enough not to ice over permanently.
Because the coal dust would absorb the sunlight
instead
of the snow reflecting it.
Exactly. You got it. You get an A in this class.
Evan, listen.
Yeah, this is good. And essentially, the U.S. more or less went nuts over this issue because it wasn't clear but what that wouldn't plunge the United States into very arid, dry conditions. The Russians have always been pretty cozy with the idea of trying to warm up the Great North. They also played around for a while with putting nuclear water pumps in the Japan Current and pulling warm water from the Pacific into the Arctic to melt the ice, again, to try to warm Siberia. The irony of this to me is if you look at what's going on in Russia right now, substantial warming occurring in central Russia, and it's an underpopulated country with respect to its area by most people's standards. It has an 8,000-mile border. Every square inch of it is hostile to one level or another. And one of the concerns is that the border between Russia and China, where you have a heavily populated country needing land and a relatively underpopulated country stretched out in its resources, doesn't become a monstrous tension zone when it warms up enough in that forest to actually grow crops there. So it could also be a kind of a political hot spot now with natural warming. But
they've also had a funny surprise in the last few years with originally being okay with the warming because they've had a plan about it, sounds like, for 50 years. And then the droughts and the heat wave that killed so many people in Moscow, and those fires out of control. They have a bit of a new attitude towards their warming.
Yeah. Well, and on our Facebook page, we have this question from Joni. She says, are the wildfires in Siberia still burning, and what effects do you foresee as a result?
Well, they're not only burning, they're burning more now than they have been in the past. There's a couple of things going on there. The Siberians refer to the wildfires in Russia as Gorbachev's gift because back in the old commie days, they flew 600 aircraft missions a day out over the northern forest, and they'd try to find fires, you know, when they were just starting. Firefighters would parachute in and fix them up and walk out. With Gorbachev and the collapse of the Soviet Empire, that went to almost no flights a day, so that the fire protection really evaporated with the fall of the Soviet Empire, and a lot more land burned across Russia. And the Russian fires are, as they say in Australia, ginormous. We were looking at some imagery of Russia across the Baikal-Amur Railroad, the Trans-Siberian Railroad. There was one place where that railroad goes through a fire scar that's 400 miles wide. So you'd ride in that train for about 6-8 hours, and you'd see nothing but charred trees the whole trip. Mm. So it's very big compared to anything we think of. Right now, the evidence from satellites is that for whatever causes, probably both human lack of fighting fires and the fact it's a lot warmer and hotter, you're getting much elevated burning across Russia. And that, of course, takes trees away. It tends to expose snow surfaces in the winter. It promotes a warming for that reason. You're reflecting heat away from the earth. And it's a complicated situation to figure out how it's going to work. But this increased fire level, much like the change in species that I talked about earlier, could make Siberia a real leverage point in terms of promoting more warming when warmed. It's the things you're not looking for at all. I mean, the other places, there's some hot places on the earth like that. I mean, this whole Antarctic ice floating into the ocean is another situation where there's this great perched ice shelf that could manifest change very quickly. Siberia is much like that. It's a place on the earth's surface where natural or man-made changes of many sorts have enough leverage to actually do things to the planet's climate.
Joni, thank you so much for that question. Hank, just to clarify before we got to Joni's question, the Russians seriously considered the suggestion of, I guess you can't really say salting, but
yes,
using
blackening the ice
with the coal dust in the Arctic. But they got some pushback from the U.S.?
Yes. That's been a long kind of strange history. You know, most people don't realize it, but in the Vietnam War, when the Pentagon Papers were published, which revealed sort of secret stuff going on in the war. The U.S. flew thousands of missions out over Cambodia and Laos and Vietnam, putting silver iodine into the clouds to promote rain. And the idea was to take the edge off the Viet Cong by making the monsoon rains last a long time. And they thought they were successful. It was secret. It ended up being published by Jack Anderson in the New York Times. Because of that, the U.S. got a lot of mud on its face about
changing the climate.
Yeah. And a resolution went through the U.N., supported by the Russians, to make it against international law to use weather and climate as a weapon of war, which still stands. It was initially weather. It was extended to climate a few years later. So the notion that you could do things strategically to either the weather or the climate to make things be advantageous to you has been around a while. And actually, during the Civil War, both the Confederates and the Yankees played with using explosives to promote rain, to gain advantages on battlefields. It turns out, you know, from where I sit, that's a rather dangerous game, because we're tinkering with things that we don't know how to untinker. If we melt the Arctic Sea and decide we don't kind of like what's happened, how do you unmelt it? Not clear. So that's one of the issues of what's called global or planetary engineering. Is, you know, the notion is if we can change the climate by carbon dioxide and stuff in the atmosphere, think what we could do if we put our minds to it. We could make this world the way we want it. Of course, who gets to control the thermostat becomes a pretty major, nasty international problem.
Systems ecologists Hank Sugart and Deborah Lawrence are our guests. This is Virginia Insight. I'm Tom Graham. Deborah, do you ever make a case to people that, other than using less fossil fuels, maybe not using as much air conditioning or not driving as much, there are other ways that they can make a small contribution to climate?
Absolutely. I mean, the whole project we're looking at is how the land surface itself can alter climate. And we all have a little patch of land wherever we live, at least lots of us have something, maybe a balcony, maybe an actual patch of dirt. I love the idea of planting trees, not just because I love trees, but it seems like everyone should have a deciduous tree planted to the southeast of the house. Not a conifer, because that will stay dark in the summer. I mean, in the winter. No. We want to have the house warmed. Yes, it's got to be deciduous. The
so
leaves
it's a
fall,
tree
the house
leaves
is warm.
Fall in the fall.
The house is warmed in the winter, and then the leaves come out and it's cooling, not because it really cools so much, but it cools enough that your AC bill is less. So, yes, everyone should be planting trees on the southeast part of their house.
Should
if they
paint
can.
My roof white?
I think that would be great.
tell me why. No, before you interrupt, Hank, tell me why you think it would be great, Deborah.
Because you would increase your albedo, which is the reflectivity of your home.
And I'm sorry, my albedo?
Your albedo. It's how much you reflect of the incoming radiation. White is good. It all goes back out to space. Doesn't warm us.
But if everybody in the world painted their roof white, that would cause a problem, you think, Hank?
Well, yeah. I mean, I think there's a scale issue involved here. In a way, cutting down the boreal forest and whitening the top of the earth is an extreme example of what everybody having white roofs. In both mm-hmm. cases, you're reflecting heat off into space.
And that would cool the climate.
Which is a cooling effect. Yeah. But it's interesting. If you look at a modern city, I was listening to NPR radio, as a matter of fact, and heard that some shiny mirror-covered building with sort of a convexity to it had somehow managed to melt a Jaguar car across the street from it, which I didn't realize Jaguars had plastic parts, but apparently they do. And this thing, it was a big curved mirror that happened to be focused on this poor devil's car. And he came back with found part of the fenders melted off of it. The moral to this little story is that, you know, if you get a lot of shiny buildings and reflective surfaces in cities, you're giving somebody else that heat. So when you drive through a city and here's this mirrored building, which is very architecturally attractive, I don't think I'd want to be in the dark-colored brick building next to it.
Oh, I'm talking about the roof.
Well, the roof. Yeah, but
you go straight back to space.
But it's all, yeah, but it
But you see that, Hank, is a version of the climate modification attempts.
The scale down.
Okay.
Scale way down. And some
Hold
levels.
Hold on just a second, if you could. We've got David who's been waiting for a while here, driving somewhere along the highway. David, thanks for joining us on Virginia Insight. Your question or comment for systems ecologist Hank Shugart and or Deborah Lawrence, please.
Terrific. Yes, thanks so much for taking my call, and thanks for this very helpful discussion. I work with New Community Project, and I think you maybe have interviewed our folks in Harrisonburg, Virginia on occasion about some of the sustainability practices there. My question, twofold. One is, I heard the discussion going a moment ago toward what can we do, and I do think the demand side has to be factored into this equation somehow, and I'm not sure how to go about that, carbon tax or whatever. But another corollary question to that is, how can you scientists, this is great information you have, it has a tremendous amount of urgency, how can you be heard and respected and then acted on by the general population? I just came from a church conference where scientists were sort of batted around. Of course, we had scientists there who were in favor of listening to the scientific advice, but then others pulling up other scientific information or sort of dismissing science in this situation. So how can you communicate, as science folks who are doing the research on the ground, how can you communicate this with a sense of urgency that gets action from the general population?
Thanks for your question. I think one of the important things that we can do is simply talk more. We can talk more to the public. We can take opportunities that sometimes scare us. We do not like to go away from our pretty places where we are surrounded by people who share our language and believe everything we say. It's hard to go out into the public and talk about ideas that we know are viewed as controversial outside those hallowed walls. I think it's important to do that, though. And I think that, in fact, when we do go out and try to use simple language and listen to people, but not give up on what we know to be true, I think that's how we can start these conversations. I think we have to be bold, and we have to actually go out and have these conversations.
Yeah, I'd like to elaborate a little bit on the religious science issue. I've just finished writing a book. I'm not really here to try to hawk books because I'm not going to quit my good day job and live off royalties, I can guarantee it. But essentially a book that takes two verses out of the book of Job, the so-called whirlwind speeches, or the divine speech,
and
talks about...
That's the new book that's just out that's called Foundations of the
Right.
Earth. Okay.
In that set of verses, God basically asked Job, do you know how I created the earth? Do you know how the rain works? Do you know how to conserve animals? Do you know how to take care of the land? It's a series of very pointed questions to which Job claims he has no answer. And I've essentially tried to write a book that sort of says, okay, here are the questions, here's their theological background, and here's what we think we may know about it. The attempt is not to somehow feed stuff to religious people. It's to engage religious people in conversations about how the planet functions. And I think there's a strong, at least in Job, a fairly strong imperative for humans to understand the earth in which they live and also how to take care of it. I might add that God makes it pretty clear that man is not a big player on the earth as he sees it in that particular set of verses.
David, thank you so very much for your time. I'm so sorry that we are just about out of time, and I wanted to get to your other book that has this wonderful title, How the Earthquake Bird Got Its Name, but I guess people are going to have to read it to find the answer, because we've got to end with this issue that we needed to get back to Deborah about. Deborah, I think you mentioned early in the hour that the agreed-upon warming of climate over the next 100 years is going to amount to somewhere between 5 to 8 degrees Fahrenheit.
Correct.
But that's the whole Earth. That's not on land.
That's right. So this is my favorite kind of statistic. When you have the whole Earth, the temperature for the whole Earth, you average out the ocean and the land.
So you got 20 seconds.
But there's a lot more ocean than there is land. So the ocean is always cooler. The land is always hotter. If we say 5 degrees Fahrenheit for the whole Earth, it's really going to be 6, 7, 8 on land. It's going to be warm.
Our guests have been University of Virginia Professor of Environmental Science Deborah Lawrence, plus UVA's Corcoran Professor of Environmental Science Hank Shugart. Hank, Deborah, thank you both so very much for making time.
Thanks for having us.
Podcasts of this program available on the Virginia Insight tab at WMRA.org. And when you get to the page for today's broadcast, you will see links to more information about both of our guests and the work they are doing. Virginia Insight's executive producer, Matt Bingay. Associate producers, Bob Levicky, Terry Ward, and Dan Easley. Some of our break music supplied by Robert Jospe and Inner Rhythm. Thanks so much for tuning in for this edition. I'm Tom Graham. Hope we can get together again soon for more insight.